Hello and welcome to Hospice News Elevate Podcast. My name is Jim Parker. I'm editor of Hospice News. And with me this episode is Ken Druck, PhD, author of How We Go On, Self-Compassion, Courage, and Gratitude on the Path Forward. And today we're going to be talking about support for family caregivers for the seriously ill, and of course, the essential topic of grief and bereavement care. Thank you so much for being here. So Ken, I wanted to ask you first if you could tell me about the personal experience that led you to do this work and ultimately write the book.
You know, Jim, the experience, it's almost difficult at times to know how far back the experience goes of writing this book. It feels like, you know, sometimes we write a book and it really is an expression of all of our life's work. And that's what I feel like this book is. It's every chapter in my life, dating all the way back, since the book goes through how we go on, how we learn to go on when faced with adversity. And that really begins with our journey as little kids. You know, what our parents, what was the dialogue? And in my parents' lives, they were the second generation that came out of the Holocaust, of all crazy things coming out of a time in history. And they named me after my grandfather's brother, who was one of the first people who spoke out against Hitler and said, this guy's going to kill all of us, and was one of the first people killed and buried in a mass grave not far from Kyiv, where people are today once again being buried in mass graves because of the Russian invasion. So anyhow, so I'm not sure how far back it goes, but one morning, having written a lot of books about 2 years ago, I started waking up in the mornings and I had that feeling that I imagine a lot of women have when they discover they're pregnant and they think, oh my God, I'm with a child. And I felt with book. That's the way us guys are, you know, we create, whether we're writing books or theater or whatever it is we're doing, whatever creative expression our life is taking. And the words, how we go on, became the center of my focus. And that's when I started writing the book and really pulling together everything I've learned, the distilled essence of everything I've learned from the death of my own daughter in 1996, my oldest daughter, Jenna, to all the families, the countless thousands of families that I've had an opportunity and a privilege to work with, who are dealing with end of life kinds of issues, and how, and the, all the elements of how we do truly go on, far past, you know, thinking positively or, you know, getting support in the immediate aftermath. How do we truly reinvent? Where do we find the refresh button? How do we approach that what now moment in our lives and meet that moment rather than running from it and avoiding it?
And would you fill our audience in on the advocacy work you've been doing and how that's reflected in the book, How We Go On?
1996, my daughter, Jenna, who was voted one of America's future leaders, called me from where she was going, Colorado, where she was going to school. She was in the President's Leadership Institute there. And she called me to say, Dad, there's this amazing opportunity. I can go and travel the world for a semester. It's called Semester at Sea. And I can travel the world and it'll just be amazing. I know the world is bigger than Colorado or California or even the United States, and I want to see and experience the world through the eyes and experiences of other people around the world, and I want to do this if it's possible. So Jenna went on Semester at Sea, had the trip of a lifetime, called me from India, Dad, I can't believe I'm going to go see the world's greatest symbol of eternal love, the Taj Mahal, tomorrow, and I love you so much. I love you, Jenna. Got off the phone, and that would be the last time I ever spoke with my daughter. After Jenna died, I knew that I had to unplug from the life that I had been living. And really what I wanted to do was to honor her life and spirit. And I did so by starting a nonprofit foundation in her name. And that the Jenna Druck Center became a twofold program. Number one, a program called Families Helping Families, to support families like mine that had suffered comparable losses of a child. And number two, a girls' leadership program, which was something my daughter had created at age 15 because she felt like there was so much more we could do to help our girls during their teen years become the best version of themselves. So anyhow, that began a long journey. And the beginning of this book really starts with the Jenna Druck Center being called in to help coordinate bereavement after 9/11, after Sandy Hook, after Columbine, after some of the greatest tragedies that most of us know about, but also in Southern California, where I live, helping 800 families a year who had suffered the death of a loved one. And really helping them really go on that grief journey through and look at how we truly go on, what we have to do when our heart has a huge hole in it, when we're walking with a limp in our heart, how we navigate that path forward through our own grief and become that better version of ourselves, even walking with a limp in our hearts.
Well, that's incredibly meaningful and impressive work that you've done. And please allow me to say that I'm very sorry to hear of your loss.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
For many, the journey of going through an illness or loss of a loved one, even the grieving process and from an anticipatory standpoint, begins with caregiving and being that person who's up at 2 a.m. to give medication, in between nurse visits or clinical visits, depending on the type of care they're receiving. I wondered how you would characterize or describe the vast burdens that caregiving can put on families based on, your interactions with families.
I think it's such an important question, is how do we take care of ourselves when we are the caregiver? How do we take care of ourselves when we're living a lot of our lives in service to somebody else's well-being, to their survival, to their care, especially in those dark night of the soul moments where it looks like this is the end of life? There's an extraordinary amount of pressure, extraordinary amount of stress, extraordinary amount of giving of ourselves. And it's so easy for those of us who are doing that work to fall out of balance. It's so easy for us to be burned out or fatigued and not even know how tired we are, how exhausted, emotionally exhausted we are, how much emotion we're having to suppress or hide or deny or avoid because of the nature of what we're going through. We're with families, we're with people who are trying to come to terms with the possibility that this is the end of their lives. And so, I've developed a protocol. I wrote a handbook called the Self-Care Handbook, and I've given it and given programs to hospital systems, to domestic violence, people who work in the field of domestic violence at international conferences, to people, to oncology groups and associations, to ALS, the LA ALS Foundation, and so on and so forth. Over the years, to people, police departments who are in high, high stress positions, who not only need to become grief literate to know how to truly support and care for people who have gone through an end of life experience or who are going through one, but how to make sure that we are taking care of ourselves, that we're getting in game shape to do this kind of work. And I, in my self-care handbook, I talk about the seven self-care saboteurs. Most of us know how to take care of ourselves, but why don't we do it? What stands in the way of us taking better care of ourselves? The first self-care saboteur, for example, is excuses. You know, that's at the top of the list. Ways that we justify inaction, procrastination, resistance, and half-hearted, yeah, I tried that, attempts at self-care. And there are other self-care saboteurs that really stand in the way. And the question is, how do we get past when we allow guilt, shame, fear, and embarrassment to stop us, when we feelings of undeservedness, when never enough perfectionism, when the fear of losing status, power, or identity? How do we get out of the way of that and reverse that, truly change, especially when those patterns are often deeply ingrained? And often it's a simple matter of learning how to catch ourselves and stop ourselves when we've got our foot on our throat rather than our hand on our heart. When we've got our foot on our throat, we're impatient, we're impulsive, we're being run by guilt and fear and a sense of hurriedness and pressure. You know, we've got to get through. We're so caught in the weeds of what's going on that we're constantly at our own throats with impatience. And when we have our hand and we catch ourselves there and we can move that hand down to our hearts, it's the hand on our heart that says we need to be patient, that not everything works on cue. We need to be supporting ourselves. We need to learn how to say yes to some things and no to other things. We need to learn how to recognize when we're working in a system or for an organization that's asking us to do three jobs, and how to make changes organizationally and systemically and make our organizations healthier and better. And it's that hand on our heart that's supportive, encouraging, humble, and is the caregiver in us that gives to us. And that's what the shift, that's the biggest core symbol of what we need, the change that we need to make in order to take better care of ourselves and be able to continue doing the work that we're doing at the high level of quality that we're providing it.
You used a term that struck me, grief literacy. Could you say more about that?
About 25 years ago, I started, when my daughter died, I realized that I had not only lost a daughter, that her life had been lost to her and had been lost to me, but that I had lost the world. I went back out into the world, hoping, thinking, and waiting for the possibility that people would be able to understand what I was going through, that my future as I had designed it had been obliterated, and that there was not a high level of understanding and empathy and sensitivity or literacy about what people go through when they're in acute grief, when they're dealing with, and they're trying to summon the courage and the strength, the compassion, the understanding, the clarity to know how to support somebody who is going through grief, who is grieving the loss of a loved one. And I coined a term, I called it grief literacy. And I was asked to teach a class at the Harvard School of Public Health, and I decided to name it grief literacy. And grief literacy is my way of simply describing the fact that too often in our cultures, we find ways to try to get around. We want to rise above it and below it and around it, rather than going through grief and walking and standing and going on the journey with people who are going through grief, rather than trying to figure out how to fix them and to figure out what they're going through and to conceptually try to work their minds, get them to think positively. And that's not the way we support people who are grieving. I have a handout I often give to families and to organizations in my compassionate workplace program and compassionate classroom programs. And it's the do's and don'ts of grief support. What I've learned personally and what I've learned from the families and the people and the professionals that I've worked with about what to say and do to support somebody who's grieving and what not to say and to do. So those have been important standards, you know, to get us to a higher level of being literate and sensitive and supportive and compassionate and effective in walking with people as they go through, as their grief journey unfolds.
I think that's a monumentally important concept, and I'm really glad you brought it up. I know even personally in my formative years, I suffered a series of losses in terms of loved ones, and I always kind of had to deal with it alone because people didn't know how to talk about it or were afraid to talk about it or didn't want to think about it. And this idea of grief literacy is remarkably intriguing to me.
What you're saying is so important, Jim. It's just critical that, you know, those of us who are effective in supporting people that we care about professionally or personally have scar tissue on our tongues from all the times we've learned to bite it and to say, just ask open-ended questions. Don't try to give don't give unsolicited advice. And ask people what they think. You know, it's like with our kids in a way. When our kid says, you know, my grandson asked me the other day, he said, "Poppy, why do we have to die?" And instead of giving him an answer and feeling like it was my job to give him the answer to that question as I've constructed it, I asked him, "What do you think? Stone, what do you think?" And learning to draw, to listen, to become expert listeners and ask questions that draw people out to find out what they think and to help them explore their options for what to think and what to do in these difficult and dark moments where they're confronting an existential crisis or a living loss or a life loss. Now, a living loss, nobody's died, but somebody's undergone a painful divorce or a terrible diagnosis, or somebody they love was in an accident, or they have a child who's strung out and or estranged, or for the first time in their life they've suffered the loss, a major loss of a job or a dream or income or a home, and they still need to somehow summon newfound strength and courage and clarity in order to put it all together to be able to go on with this life. And even not just to go through the motions, but to become that better version of ourselves. In the last chapter of How We Go On, I actually, because this question is so important, the question about dealing with death, I called it my moonshot. And it's called Ken's Moonshot, Dealing with Death. And it starts with telling readers, saying, please, I apologize for being so presumptuous about writing it, that I'm going to write a chapter on death so that we don't spend the rest of our lives in dread or fear, that we gain some measure of peace about the fact that death is a part of life. And I said, I'm being so presumptuous in assuming that you're going to read this chapter and that you're going to have peace at the end of it. But thank you for your courage and faith in me to at least give it a try. And it's a chapter about death and about coming to terms. And it's about putting what we do that allows us to put our house in order spiritually, physically, legally, financially. We know most of the financial and legal things. But what about in terms of our relationships? What about our own fears? What about our own anticipatory grief about losing, about our life passing, and our unknowingness about now what? What happens after we die? What do I believe? What gives me comfort? What do I really think? And how can I allow myself a time of unknowingness and embrace this mystery rather than run and live in fear of it?
Thank you. Our listeners are, of course, hospice providers who are involved in providing bereavement care to families for at least 13 months after a loved one dies. And many of them offer bereavement care to members of the community, whether or not their loved ones were a patient. So I'm curious, based on your work and based on your research, what would you say are the most important thing that hospice providers, that grief care providers need to understand about what families are experiencing?
What a great question. I'm going to stop your sentence at the word need to understand. It's not just about families, because you, with your hand on your heart, the hand of kindness and of acknowledgement and of appreciation, of feeling, of knowing with clarity that you've entered a realm that most people run from, want to hide, deny, repress, avoid at any cost, and that you are one of the people that goes towards the fire, like the firefighter who goes towards, you're a person in noble service to families, to individuals who are dealing with one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult aspect of what this life is. And you are not only teaching, you are modeling, you are an example, you are the embodiment of courage. You are the embodiment of support and compassion. So I encourage, the first thing is to please make sure that your hand is on your heart and that you catch yourself if your foot is on your throat with some kind of admonishment or self-criticism or self-condemnation or marginalizing what you do or minimizing it or not, or justifying not taking care of yourself. The code of self-care that keeps us in game shape to do this honorable work. So that's the place I'd like to start. The second thing in terms of understanding families is really, you know, making sure that we haven't set up expectations about how what we're saying and doing and the sacrifices that we make to do the work we do is going to be appreciated or acknowledged in a certain way. You know, right now I'm working with a family whose 9-year-old daughter will be buried tomorrow. I've been working with them for 2 years. And, you know, they in the rawness of their grief, there are very few thank yous and acknowledgments. There's a lot of family fighting and arguments and disagreements and brokenheartedness beyond description, unspeakable pain and sorrow, and all the cumulative effects of having watched this beautiful young girl wither and die. And so I think making sure that we understand that it's up to us and to each other as a support group in the organizations that we work to acknowledge the work we're doing, the sacrifices that we're making, and that we haven't set up expectations that we're always going to get glowing thank yous and acknowledgments, no matter how hard we've worked, no matter how much we've sacrificed, no matter how much in service or a gift we have been to the family that we're working with, and that everything that comes in beautifully and graciously in appreciation is a bonus. It's not an expectation. The second thing I'll say is to make sure that you don't have your foot on your throat with not knowing the answer to everything, or not knowing how to respond to everything, or not knowing what to do at every turn. That our unknowingness, we have to be at peace with the fact that we don't know everything. And there are certain situations we've never had to face, that we're learning, that we're a work in progress. We're learning as we go. So to make sure that your hand is on your heart, allowing, how could I possibly know? Of course, I'm uncertain, but allowing our uncertainty and unknowingness as we open ourselves to greater knowing, to greater understanding, to asking open-ended questions, and having being a reflection, having what we do be a reflection of what the family really wants, what's in their nature to do or not to do. And the last thing is, I would say, to cultivate a spirituality even deeper than the one you've cultivated, is to give yourself, I start every day, for example, you know, if certain monks start their day by saying, this is my last day of life. What's most important? How do I want to live it? You know, I start my day every day with a meditation walk. And I try in that walk, I ask myself questions, and I give myself time to nurture and listen to my own heart, and to listen to the things that I've learned from other people and teachings, the great teachings that give me a sense of spiritual understanding, deepening, resilience, so that when I walk into these situations that are so much a part of my profession, that I have continuously cultivated a sense of spirituality, a sense of understanding, or a respect for the unknowing parts of what I do. That is, I'm at peace with those things, and I'm at greater peace with death. And those are the things that I would say I would wish, that would be my hope and prayer for all the great people that are working in this field.
Oh, that's really wonderful to hear. Thank you so much for the really insightful conversation. I enjoyed it, and found it enlightening. I really appreciate you being here.
You're so very welcome, Jim. My pleasure, and I'm honored to be able to share with all the good folks that are going to be listening to this, and to continue to learn from them. So I welcome anybody's feedback and thoughts or any acknowledgement that of what was helpful, so that I can continue learning, growing, and deepening myself.
Thank you very much, Ken, for your time and for your insights. This podcast has been brought to you by the WTWH Media Publications, Hospice News, and Palliative Care News. And I'd like to thank everyone for listening in. Please take care.